This podcast contains coarse language, dark humor, descriptions of violence, and controversial opinions. Listener discretion is advised. Well, hello there. Are you lost? What the hell are you doing in my corner of the internet? If you find that you've knocked on the wrong door, but you like what you hear, please subscribe. Leave me ratings and reviews, all that jazz. Between you and me, I am going through a lot of shit right now. Finances are getting tight, court cases are stacking up, I'm fucking struggling. As we speak, I'm having a mild panic attack thinking my ex is somehow gonna get in my house and shoot me. Anxiety is a hell of a thing. If you want to support me and get a bit of bonus content when it's available, check me out on Subscribestar. $5 a month will get you early releases when my dumbass can get back into writing them early, as well as bonus episodes as they come out. Either way, I appreciate y'all whether you want to pay me or not. Much love to all of you. Back when I was in fifth grade, a literal eternity ago, all three fifth grade classes did this little fair thing where we each had to do a presentation about a state. Mine was Rhode Island. I dressed up as a Rhode Island red hen. Fucking hilarious. I'll see if I can find a picture from back then and throw it up on the Instagram if I have it. This is one of those states that I sometimes forget exists. It's tiny. Literally the smallest state in the US. Doesn't strike me as a place that has crime or the death penalty. Spoiler alert, the death penalty has been gone for a long time, since 1984 officially, but they haven't executed anyone since 1845. Those East Coast motherfuckers really just don't like putting people down. Of the 52 people executed in Rhode Island, a whopping 32 were put down for piracy. Not murder, not rape, not any of the other ridiculous colonial crimes I've seen. Fucking piracy. Look at me, I'm the captain now. I've actually always been the captain, but whatever. There is actually a ship captain in the large group of condemned pirates that I'm going to be telling you about today. Everyone on the list, with an execution method listed, was hanged, I guess. Shooting people for desertion makes more sense than for piracy. Who knows? This state is definitely a weird one. Probably no last meals here, but I'll try. What do Rhode Islanders even eat? Oh, duh, chickens. That was obvious. New Jersey had a lot of famous people, if I'm remembering correctly, but Rhode Island is home to my favorite fictional family, the Griffins. There's a whole episode of Family Guy about a murder mystery, but I think today I'll stick with real life. So grab some shake and bake and a clam knife. Today we're heading up to the Ocean State. There are three definitions for the word piracy. Copyright or patent infringement, the hijacking of an airplane, or robbery or other serious acts of violence committed at sea. Our first case took place long before Pirate Bay and uTorrent. Hell, long before airplanes. It took place all the way back in July of 1723. Captain Jack Sparrow isn't the only famous pirate of the Caribbean. And yeah, I'm gonna say it like that, fuck you. I've never even seen that movie. I can almost see Bigfoot sighing and rolling his eyes right now. In an era before planes could transport goods across the ocean, ships were the only way to trade. This led to criminals doing criminal things out at sea. Why do hard labor for an honest living when you can steal from passing ships? Edward Low was an English pirate known for the sheer brutality of his actions. Remember last week when we talked about Gary Heidnik mixing a woman's ground-up body parts with dog food and feeding it to his other captives? Well, I think I've found his match. Low and his sidekick, Charles Harris, plundered many ships between New England and the Caribbean islands. They used grotesque tactics to get their victims to tell where the loot was hidden. One ship captain met his end at Low's hands after having his own lips cut off, roasted, and fed to him. Another officer was forced to eat the heart of his shipmate. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle once referred to Low as a man of amazing and grotesque brutality. He wasn't exaggerating. During his 3 years as a pirate, Low managed to capture at least 100 ships. In the summer of 1723, he and his partner in crime, Charles Harris, were sailing north from the Caribbean. The men in their two ships chased down this lone vessel, only to find that it was a British warship, the HMS Greyhound. Low's ship had 10 cannons and about 70 men. Harris had 50 men and 8 big guns. I'm not sure what a 1700s big gun is. I think the shotgun sitting next to me is pretty big, but I don't know. It was all just muskets and cannons back then. These two murderous thieves chased down the Greyhound and ordered it to surrender. The captain refused and began a battle with the two pirates. It lasted just a day before Harris had to surrender his ship. Captain Charles Harris and 25 of his men were executed by hanging on July 19, 1723. Two men who had been forced into piracy were spared. From Boston to New York, people celebrated the deaths of these criminals. This crime isn't one that usually comes to mind when we think of capital offenses, but this was a different time. Piracy often came with murder, and in this case, torture as well. Edward Low escaped from the battle on June 10, 1723, with his life. It's not known exactly what happened to him in the end. Some say he died in a shipwreck. Others think he was executed for his crimes in Martinique. This man did terrible things in the name of money. Whatever he got was too good for him. I don't have any last words or last meals for you with this one, so instead I'll leave you with the words of Puritan minister Cotton Mather. It was the hand of the glorious God which brought these criminals to die. Take a due notice of what you've seen in the way which these wicked men have trodden, and in the fearful end in which their way has brought them to. Never thought I could agree with a Christian minister about anything. Wow. Immigration is one of those issues that has always divided people and probably always will. I am the descendant of immigrants. I can trace my great-great-grandfather back to Denmark. He came through Ellis Island around the turn of the century. Mormon pioneers make up a significant chunk of the other half of my lineage. Though I'm sure it couldn't have been easy to come across the Atlantic at the age of 7 and learn an entirely new language, great-great-grandpa Hans had it a lot easier than some other immigrants in history. John Gordon was born in Ireland in the early 1800s. He and his brother Nicholas came to the U.S. in search of a better life. Nicholas owned a tavern in Cranston, Rhode Island. In the summer of 1843, a man named Amasa Sprague found himself in a bit of a feud with the Gordon brothers. Amasa owned a textile factory. Nothing too special, but he definitely wasn't struggling. His brother William was a U.S. senator. I obviously didn't know this guy, but he strikes me as an 1800s trust fund frat boy, if such a thing existed. On New Year's Eve, 1843, Amasa took a walk after having dinner with his family in his mansion. There's no way he could have seen what was coming. A shot rang out, and Amasa was struck in the arm with a single bullet. This incapacitated him long enough for two men to begin beating him with a blunt object. His cause of death was blunt force trauma to both sides of his skull. Amasa's servant found his body later that night. His face was so disfigured from the beating he'd received that only the doctor who examined his body could identify him. While no suspects were immediately apparent, they were able to determine that robbery wasn't the motive. A gold watch and $60 cash were found with Amasa's body. This looked to be a murder committed in the name of vengeance. Irish immigrants have never been treated well in the U.S. Maybe in modern times, but throughout history, the Irish have gone through hell. In the 1800s, the Protestant populations of the U.S. looked down upon their Roman Catholic Irish neighbors. Here we go again, doing violence because some people worship God in a slightly different way. I've never understood it. Nicholas Gordon's tavern was located in the Knightsville neighborhood of Cranston. Protestants in the area referred to this neighborhood as Monkey Town due to the high number of Irish immigrants living there. I thought white people couldn't experience racism, though. This entire story has to be bullshit. A possible motive became clear soon after Amasa's murder, one that the Protestants of the time gripped onto with all their strength. Amasa's mill workers would often go drink at Nicholas's bar and get drunk when they were supposed to be working. Now, who hasn't called in sick so they can get shit-faced on a Tuesday? This guy needs to chill. Amasa got tired of his employees drinking on the clock and decided to take it out on the establishment they were visiting. He used his family's political influence to revoke Nicholas's liquor license. Amasa and Nicholas were seen fighting, in public, a handful of times. At one point, the two bumped into each other on a path and had a bit of a standoff. Eventually, Amasa grabbed Nicholas by the collar of his shirt and yelled, "Get out of the way, you damned Irishman!" Again, we are in a time where one man's Christianity is another man's blasphemy, and I just do not understand. 2 months before Amasa was murdered, a man named Thomas Dorr had been arrested and charged with trying to set up a rival government in Rhode Island that would give the vote to all white men, not just the rich ones with property. Obviously, the local Irish population supported Dorr and his rebellion. They were working-class white men, after all. Isn't it funny how the times have changed? Back then, you could be thrown in the slammer for trying to peacefully overthrow your government. Today, you can light entire cities on fire and protest and not even be arrested. It's a strange world we're living in. Why did I bring up Thomas Dorr? Well, it just so happens that his downfall was brought about by a man named Amasa Sprague and his senator brother William. Maybe it was Dorr's supporters that had murdered Amasa. After all, the Irish always stick together. Shortly after the murder, police arrested Nicholas Gordon and his two younger brothers. Rather than run with the political motive, the police kept it simple and just assumed Nicholas was pissed about losing his liquor license. Oh, and their dog was also arrested. I guess they thought the dog might have bitten Amasa on the neck or something. Forensic science, hell, common sense, has come a long way in the last few centuries. In court, the defense described the dog as toothless and old. I bet that was one hell of a court transcript. William and John Gordon were tried together before their brother Nicholas. This case had a bit of fuckery going on behind the scenes. Nicholas owned a gun, which had gone missing around the time of the murder. A broken gun was found near Amasa's body, and it was assumed that it belonged to Nicholas. This was entirely untrue. William had hidden his older brother's firearm to prevent police from casting their suspicions onto him. Nicholas Gordon was tried twice for the murder of Amasa Sprague, and both trials ended in a hung jury. He had an alibi, and no witnesses could accurately place him at the scene of the murder. William Gordon was acquitted of murder. He had the support of the Irish community behind him and somehow managed to convince a jury that he was not the guilty party. John Gordon was executed by hanging on February 14, 1845. There really wasn't any evidence against him, other than the fact that he was the brother of a man who had a powerful enemy. Guilt by association is a real thing. John was posthumously pardoned on June 29, 2011. John's last words were, "I hope all good Christians will pray for me." Due to the time period, there is nothing available on his last meal. Rhode Island crimes are different, I guess. Piracy, being Catholic, you know, the really bad stuff. Serial killers are a West Coast thing, if you ask me. California is a breeding ground for really fucked up people. I bet it would surprise you to hear that I found an 80s serial killer in fucking Rhode Island, of all places. Drugs don't mix well with some people. As a person who's spent a night or two tripping my balls off on some really good acid, I have a hard time understanding what about that particular drug triggers some people to do really fucked up things. Even in my worst trip, when I was alone and freaking out that the government was gonna get me, all I did was block the entrances to my bedroom. Never had a violent thought on acid. Almost shit the bed once, but that's a story for another day. Craig Price apparently had some kind of underlying mental issues. I'm struggling to find much on his early life other than that he came from a working-class family in Warwick. I'm probably saying this town name wrong, but I don't give a shit. I don't speak New England. We've been over this. Price committed his first murder at the ripe old age of 13. Yeah, I'm kind of shocked too, honestly. On July 27th, 1987, he stabbed 27-year-old Rebecca Spencer 58 times with a knife from her own kitchen. She was his neighbor, and he'd spied on her a number of times before he finally struck. What the fuck is wrong with this kid? Seriously. Rebecca's murder went unsolved for 2 years until another disturbing attack took place in September of 1989. Three more of Price's neighbors were brutally attacked in their home. Joan Heaton was a 39-year-old mom trying to raise her two daughters. Price cut her life short with 57 stab wounds. Joan's 10-year-old daughter Jennifer would meet a similar end after witnessing her mother's murder. And 7-year-old Melissa was stabbed 30 times after having her skull crushed. Price was so vicious with his attacks that the knife blades broke off inside all three of his victims. This crime probably would have gone unsolved as well, if not for a single officer paying close attention. Who's gonna suspect a 15-year-old black kid of slaughtering four of his white female neighbors? This ain't the 60s. One of the cops who interviewed Price noticed a large cut on his hand and questioned him about it. Without hesitation, he confessed to the murders, even told the cops that he'd bitten Joan's face while he was stabbing her. This one is a sick puppy for sure, and he blamed it all on drugs. The FBI couldn't even profile this kid. He could have gotten away with four murders and probably gone on to kill even more, if not for one cop noticing a cut on his hand. Price had no remorse for his actions and blamed white people for his desire to kill. He claimed that some white adults had yelled racial slurs at him and tried to run him over when he was a young kid. I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure what happened. Seems more, sexually motivated to me, though. Craig Chandler Price was convicted of assault and sentenced to 25 years on January 18th, 2019. If you thought he was just a fucked up kid that would learn from his mistakes, you are terribly wrong. Throughout his time in prison, Price has been so violent that the authorities chose to move him from Rhode Island to Florida. It is because of his crimes that Rhode Island finally passed laws that made it possible for juveniles to be charged as adults in serious crimes such as murder. He has been charged with a handful of other offenses while behind bars, including extortion, criminal contempt, and probation violations. Price's juvenile records were supposed to be sealed once he turned 21, but apparently they weren't because, yeah, we're here talking about him right now. Price is 50 now. There's a decent chance that he'll actually die in prison. Remember back in Oklahoma, the case of Richard Fairchild and his drunken rage? Well, when I first started the research for this episode, I figured that Rhode Island wouldn't have a lot of variety in their crimes. Turns out that there are just as many fucked up people here as there are in larger states. This one had me wishing capital punishment was still an option. Cases like this deserve it. Every time. Nothing pisses me off more than a child abuser. Except a child abuser who tries to blame someone else for their shitty actions. If I had the option, I'd carry out the executions for this crime. On October 29th, 2004, a 15-year-old girl named Kayla was babysitting five children at an apartment in Woonsocket. Oh, did I forget to mention that there are basically no normal sounding town names in Rhode Island. Seriously, it's... who the fuck named these places? One of the children was a 3-year-old boy named TJ. Why a 15-year-old was watching 5 little kids? Jesus. I struggle with 2 and I'm almost 30. Kayla was doing this as a favor for a woman named Catherine Bunnell and her boyfriend, Gilbert Delestre, so they could go out drinking. God, what I wouldn't give to have a babysitter on my weekend. Feels like an eternity since I had a proper night off. Everything was fine until Bunnell and Delestre came home at 2:30 the next morning. TJ, who was Bunnell's nephew, had been struggling to sleep the night before, so Kayla decided to let him sleep on the couch. She later fell asleep on the floor next to where he was laying. Kayla was woken up suddenly when the adults got home. Bunnell was screaming, "What happened to my fucking house? Why is there a mess all over the floor?" "Because, you stupid bitch, there is a 3-year-old in the house. Take my word for it, toddlers are a fucking mess. Take a 3-hour nap and the whole house is wrecked." Kayla said that the mess Bunnell was freaking out about was milk mixed with yogurt that had spilled on the carpet. Definitely making me think of my son. That's his thing lately, mixing his drinks into everything. I found an empty bottle of bubbles inside his cup of milk the other day. Kids are curious. Sometimes curiosity turns into a giant mess. This mess seemed pretty tame, but maybe I'm just biased because my son is an actual tornado. Bunnell was furious that her carpet had been spilled on and asked Kayla what happened. Noticing that TJ was no longer on the couch, she said that maybe TJ did it. How the hell was she supposed to know? She was asleep. It was, after all, 2:30 in the goddamn morning. Delestre went upstairs, and shortly after, Kayla heard 3 or 4 slaps followed by TJ crying. Bunnell followed her boyfriend upstairs and questioned TJ's brother before grabbing the 3-year-old by the arms and dangling him in front of her. As she descended the stairs, her knee hit TJ in the back with every step. Once they got to the bottom of the stairs, Bunnell dropped TJ from about 2.5 feet in the air. He landed on his stomach and smacked his face into the floor. This little boy was 3. All I can picture is my sweet little Xerxes, and it's breaking my heart. TJ tried to get up off the floor, but Bunnell grabbed him by the wrists and yanked him up before he even had a chance. TJ stood next to his aunt while she berated him about the mess. He cried like any child would. He didn't make the mess on purpose. He was just playing, and it happened. Kayla watched as Bunnell punched TJ in the chest and back a few times. The little boy was knocked to the ground again before being pulled back up by the wrists and punched a few more times, all while being yelled at by a drunk, angry psychopath. The third time Bunnell tried to pull TJ up off the floor, he didn't stand up all the way. He was limp, probably from being pummeled by a grown-ass woman. The little boy fell backward and smacked the back of his head into the floor. At this point, he was no longer moving. Bunnell wasn't finished, though. She continued ranting about how her apartment was a mess and it was TJ's fault, all while slapping him across the face. This bitch continued beating the hell out of her 3-year-old nephew while yelling in his face, calling him stupid, and coming unglued over a bowl of fucking yogurt on the floor. She dragged him up again and he fell into a closet door, once again hitting his head. Bunnell slapped him across the face again with the force of 2 teenage girls fighting. As if this wasn't bad enough, Bunnell then decided to pour milk on TJ's head. This went on for about 10 seconds. The little boy just sat there, dazed and crying, as his aunt unleashed her rage on him. After she finally finished berating her nephew and making an even bigger mess, Bunnell asked Kayla if she wanted to go home. Kayla said yes, so the woman started looking for her car keys. As she was waiting, Kayla looked outside for a minute. When she turned back around, she saw TJ a few feet in the air. It looked as though he was falling, like someone had thrown him. Kayla watched as TJ traveled 4 or 5 feet through the air from where Delestre was now standing. The man looked at his girlfriend and told her to get TJ out of here before I drop him. The little boy landed on his stomach with his leg twisted underneath him. He once again hit his face on the floor. In case you need a reminder, which I certainly don't, This little boy was 3. By this point, TJ had pretty much given up. Bunnell tried to pick him up by the wrists again and make him walk, but he wouldn't move. He was breathing heavily and made no effort to even hold himself up. Bunnell finally found her car keys and drunkenly drove Kayla home, because, yeah, that's a great idea. God damn, I hate this bitch. When she returned, Delestre came toward her and told her to go check on TJ. Bunnell ran upstairs and called out his name, but got no response. She went into the bedroom and found him unresponsive. In an attempt to wake him up, the still probably drunk woman got water from the sink and splashed it onto TJ's head. I've been in an emergency situation with a small child before. Told the story on stream once when I was shit-faced. I'll probably tell it again in a future episode. I was thankfully sober at the time, but it was terrifying. Once you realize something is wrong with your baby, your brain tries to think of anything and everything you can do to remedy the situation. My son was cold, so I got a warm bath and tried to raise his body temperature that way. It didn't work, so I drove to the hospital. Just so you don't think I'm insane, there's a hospital literally 30 seconds from my house. It was faster for me to drive than wait for an ambulance. Bunnell, in her drunken state, finally decided to yell for her boyfriend to call 911 because TJ was blue.
Oh, ma'am, calm down.
Calm down,
what's the address?
When the fire department responded to a call about a sick child, they found traumatic injuries on TJ, as well as blood and vomit around his mouth. TJ's face was swollen and bruised. His left arm was disfigured and bruised and looked like it could be broken. Similar injuries were found on the little boy's thigh. When asked what the fuck happened, Bunnell told the first responders that they had come home from their night out and found TJ in the crib in that condition. She claimed that she'd gone out with Delestre and his cousin, and when they arrived home, she waited in the car while the men went in to get Kayla, an obvious lie that would later be disproven by the eyewitness testimony of that brave babysitter. Delestre spun a similar story, claiming that he'd gone upstairs to check on the kids and found TJ laying halfway out of his bed, totally limp. An officer asked him where everything took place, and he replied, "It happened upstairs." These cops, being good cops, decided to ask the other kids what had happened. Bunnell immediately instructed them to tell the police what the babysitter did. She was still drunk and began yelling at the other kids in an attempt to get them to corroborate her story. "Tell the fucking police what the babysitter did to TJ!" The emergency responders had arrived in time to get TJ into an ambulance and on his way to a hospital. Unfortunately, by 6:30 a.m., he was comatose, and things weren't looking good. This sweet little boy. Holy shit, it hurts to write this. He was taken off life support at 7 a.m. and passed away from his injuries. I'm gonna read you bits of the autopsy report, because I want you to really get a feel for how fucked up this baby's death was. I described to you the events of the night, seen through the eyes of a 15-year-old babysitter. Combine that with the opinions of the medical examiner, and you've got yourself one hell of a slam-dunk capital case. It's a damn shame that Rhode Island doesn't put down violent psychopaths. At the time of TJ's death, the 3-year-old weighed 32 pounds and was 3 feet tall. He had multiple blunt traumatic injuries of the head, including injuries on the left cheek, left ear, right ear, on both temples, and on his forehead. He was bruised on his forehead, his left eye, right eyebrow, cheekbone, and from the front of his left ear all the way to the back. His left cheek had a patterned injury that appeared to be a handprint left by a slap. TJ's mouth and lips were also badly damaged. He had bitten his tongue so hard that it hemorrhaged inside. His leg was broken. The brain injuries, though. Holy fucking shit. Giving me some flashbacks that are bringing tears to my eyes. TJ had a large subdural hematoma on the left side of his brain, severe swelling, and the brain itself had shifted from the left side of his skull to the right. All of this indicated that he'd had at least one serious impact to the left side of his head. At least. Gilbert Delestre was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison plus 10 years on February 18, 2009. He will be eligible for parole after 23 years. Why he's even eligible is just... what the fuck? These two should never have a chance at freedom again. TJ didn't get a chance at life, why should they? Catherine Bunnell was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison plus 10 years on October 6th, 2008. She will be eligible for parole after 25 years. This woman deserves to have someone get blackout drunk and beat the shit out of her. Throw her across her room. Dump milk on her head while she cries. She killed her own nephew, who was in her care because his mother was in prison. If she couldn't handle five kids at once and all the stress that comes with, maybe she shouldn't have agreed to take in her sister's kids. I need to prepare y'all a last meal. It's in the name of the podcast. I owe it to you. For this next one, we are traveling across state lines. Many state lines. The tie to Rhode Island is so loose with this case, I almost feel like I shouldn't include it. But I'm sure you're all hungry for a last meal after hearing the tale of two drunk morons beating a toddler to death and getting a chance at parole, so into the car we go for a cross-country adventure. I've probably mentioned a handful of times that my grandma used to be a truck driver. Not Arizona grandma, the other one. I spent part of a summer out on the road with her when I was a kid. Truckers are interesting creatures. As someone who sits at a desk for a living, I can almost sympathize with them. I'm chained to a desk for 8 hours. They're chained to a steering wheel for probably double that every day. It's not an easy job. Maybe that's why John Fountainberry stopped doing it in 1990. The man found himself earning cash by unloading trucks at a truck stop near Portland, Oregon, and met a man named Donald Nutley. The two went shooting together. As they were leaving the range, Fountainberry shot Donald in the head and stole $10,000 cash from him. Hell of a way to start a friendship. After the theft, this murderous psycho drove to Cincinnati, Ohio, and stayed with his sister for a while. He then made his way up to Connecticut to visit a different friend. Sometime in February of 1991, Fountainberry decided to head back to Ohio from where he was staying in Rhode Island. There it is. There's the extremely loose tie I was telling you about. He stopped at a truck stop in New Jersey on the way back out west to see if he could panhandle some money for gas. It was here that he met a man named Gary Farmer. Maybe Fountainberry was charming or something, like a Ted Bundy, because Gary was more than happy to buy him some breakfast and give him money for gas. But we already know how Fountainberry treats his friends. The two men got into Gary's truck, and Fountainberry shot him in the head before taking his wallet and driving off towards Cincinnati. He once again stayed with his sister for a while before leaving in search of money. Fountainberry was on foot this time, and had plans to go back to Oregon. Hitchhiking was apparently the way to go. Isn't that a 70s thing? Like, what the fuck? I saw a guy walking north along Highway 89 in Arizona trying to hitchhike the last time I went down there, and can I just say, that was gonna be a hell no from me, dog. This ain't the 70s. Fountainberry was on Interstate 275 when a young man named Joseph Darren stopped and offered him a ride. Joseph was a father of two who just wanted to stop and help this guy out. Fountainberry explained that he was trying to get to Columbus, and Joseph told the man he'd drop him off at a restaurant near the I-71 junction so he'd have better luck. Once they reached the restaurant, Fountainberry repaid Joseph for his kindness with two shots to the head and stole his car. He dumped this poor young man's body into a wooded area near the Ohio River and then used his cash and vehicle to get back to Oregon. When Fountainberry arrived in Portland, he met up with his friend Wes at a bar. A handful of people were invited back to Wes's apartment to continue partying. One of these people was Christine Guthrie. She would later go with Fountainberry out to Rockaway, Oregon, to stay at a motel. Not sure exactly what they were doing, but I have a pretty good guess. On the way back to Portland, the two drove out to a wooded area under the pretense that they would find something interesting. As Christine walked ahead of Fountainberry into the woods, she was shot 3 times in the back of the head. Her credit card was taken, and she was left out in the wilderness alone. this dude, he looks fucking off, like a weird inbred offspring of Dahmer and Bundy trapped in the 90s. He did make one smart decision, though. In March of 1991, Fountainberry made his way all the way up to Juneau, Alaska, so he could work on a fishing boat and get drunk. That's the dream. That's the fucking dream. While here, he met a man named Jefferson Diffie, who invited him over to hang out at his apartment. Again, we already know how Fountainberry treats his friends. He handcuffed Jefferson, beat him, and stabbed him to death. The police caught him this time. Not sure what was different about this murder than the other ones, but the Alaska cops got him. He pled guilty to first-degree murder and was given the maximum sentence allowed at the time. 99 years without the chance of parole. While sitting in jail in Alaska, Fountainberry kept running his mouth to the cops about the other murders he'd committed. He even gave up the locations of the bodies. Now, if you've been here before and paid close attention to certain cases, you'll know that most states without the death penalty don't like to extradite prisoners to the states that do have it. You know, goes against their morals or whatever. Alaska wasn't like that in the 90s. They were more than happy to hand Fountainberry over to the state of Ohio, where he'd be facing a date with the needle. John Joseph Fountainberry was executed by lethal injection on July 14th, 2009. Though he confessed to 5 murders, he was only convicted of 2. I guess that's all they needed. Rachel Darren, who was 4 at the time of her father's murder, attended his execution but waited outside the death chamber as it happened. She told a reporter, "I know he's not sorry. He didn't care. And even if he did, it's not going to bring my dad back or any of the other victims back." Ohio's governor at the time denied Fountainberry's last-minute plea for clemency. The parole board also voted unanimously to reject mercy on this psychopath. All of the people he killed had been kind to him in some way. He repaid that kindness with bullets. People like this should be put down. Fountainberry didn't have any last words. His last meal was 2 sunny-side-up eggs, 2 pieces of fried bologna, fried potatoes, 4 untoasted pieces of wheat bread, 4 pieces of white toast with butter, 4 tomato slices, a piece of lettuce, mayo on the side, 2 packages of Reese's peanut butter cups, and 2 Three Musketeers bars. Definitely a fucking weird one. Rhode Island may not execute people anymore, but like every other state on the East Coast, they have their share of crime. Very Baltimore-esque crimes, to be honest. Finding a recent one to throw in here at the end was making me angry. On April 1st, 2022, at a club in Providence, 2 groups of people began fighting. I bet you weren't expecting Rhode Island to have gang violence, were you? It's not clear exactly what happened, but everyone was kicked out of the club and the fight continued outside. Members of the East Side Gang had come up on 30-year-old Angelo Gomez as he was walking away. A black SUV was seen leaving the club on surveillance cameras around this same time. The SUV then turned around and headed back toward the gang. Angelo was trying to get away. The driver of the black SUV fired 3 shots at him before speeding away. Angelo was taken to the hospital, where he held on for about a week before succumbing to his injuries. The suspect wasn't immediately located. Police had to track him down in Sandy Springs, Georgia, before they could catch him. Robert Kamlan was found guilty of first-degree murder and a handful of gun charges on April 5th, 2024. He is currently awaiting sentencing. My guess is life in prison plus 10 years with the chance of parole after 25 years. That's what happens when you drink and crime in Rhode Island, remember? This case was tragic. All murders are. The Attorney General decided to add his 2 cents into it, stating, "When violent criminals can easily access guns, lives are lost." I guess no one's told him about the rigorous background checks and training courses you have to go through to get a gun in Rhode Island. They are a very blue state with very blue gun policies. Maybe that's why they have such a problem with gun violence. Criminals will always do criminal things. Law-abiding citizens will always adhere to the law. Maybe if Rhode Island took the stick out of their ass and relaxed their gun laws a little bit, more people would be comfortable with carrying self-defense weapons. But what the hell do I know? I'm just a biased right-winger living in the mountains. Got a little political at the end there. Sorry about that. Had to wash the taste of child abuse out of my mouth. If you enjoyed this episode, dye some letters on chicken eggs and spell them out into a review. Share this tiny episode all over your internet. You can get me on Instagram and Twitter at LastMealPod. There's a bonus episode out on Subscribestar that you can hear if you want to kick me $5 a month. More to come, hopefully soon. I don't know. It's been a fucking insane couple of weeks. Now that I've given my ex the finger and started paying for my own internet, you can also, once again, catch me live on Rumble and Odyssey on Thursday nights, talking recent crime news and other drama. I hope to see you there. I'll be back next week with an episode about the irreparably broken youth of this country. Gonna be a controversial one for sure. Cursed is the man who dies, but the evil done by him survives. See you next time.